From awaytogarden.com and robinhoodradio.com, this is Away to Garden with Margaret Roach, your weekly invitation to dig in and grow.
Increasingly in recent years, my garden weeds include more and more tenacious opponents, and the landscape along the roadsides nearby and pretty much everywhere I drive is one of hedgerows formed of a tangle of non-native shrubs and vines. I'm talking about invasive species, of course, and they are our topic today with Daniel Witosh of Cornell Botanic Gardens. We'll hear how to identify which plants to target as we try to manage our landscapes and how to tackle them most strategically. So more in a moment, but first, these messages.
Underwriting support for A Way to Garden provided by Color Blends Wholesale Flower Bulbs, a third-generation bulb company offering top-size flower bulbs directly to landscape professionals and ambitious residential gardeners at wholesale prices. On the web, colorblends.com. And by High Mowing Seeds, Wolcott, Vermont, offering 30 new seed varieties for 2024. Professional quality vegetable, flower, and herbal seeds that are 100% organic and non-GMO project verified. On the web, highmowingseeds.com. And by White Flower Farm, offering a wide range of carefully selected and expertly grown garden plants. On the web, whiteflowerfarm.com.
Daniel Witosh is the arboriculture supervisor at Cornell Botanic Gardens in Ithaca, New York, where he and his colleagues care for the woody plants at the 30-acre botanic garden, plus a 100-acre arboretum and about 3,600 acres of natural areas. You may recall a conversation he and I had on the show not long ago about the increasing challenges of gardening in a changing climate, and today's topic about managing invasives is likewise one made more complex by our warming world. So welcome back to the program, Daniel. How are you?
I'm doing great. Thank you for having me again.
Okay. And remember the good old days when the most dreaded weed was a dandelion? Oh my goodness.
Specific tools for that singular little plant.
I know, right? Right.
I don't think we're going back anytime soon.
No. So as I hinted at in the introduction, you know, some of the non-native plants that used to, you know, I'd see 10 years ago and 20 years ago along the local roadsides where I live in, basically everywhere, you know, they're now occupying every square foot. I mean, it's like a jungle of invasives. And is this yet another sort of gift that keeps on giving of our changing climate, as I implied in the intro? I mean, is that what you all are thinking, is that This is one of the side effects of what's going on with the climate?
Yeah, it can continue to get more invasive, potentially, a given species. And the additional gift that we get there is that brand new species who previously were very well behaved, they're now displaying invasive qualities. So it's with those changing climates, this is, I don't think it's going to make battling invasive plants any easier.
No, I know, because I feel like some things that I used to see, you know, a little bit of, and then a little more of, it's now like, you know, it's every square inch is covered with the things. Do you know what I mean? It's just, it's amazing. Do you make a distinction between weed and invasive, or do you know what I mean? Is there some kind of cutoff word? How do you kind of figure that out, or don't?
Sure. There are guidelines that state agencies are using to determine, in a weed assessment capacity, is this an invasive plant? They're considering how well does it propagate? Does it crowd out other natives? For us at the Botanic Gardens, what we tackle is somewhere between that very firm designation, weed versus invasive, right plant or wrong plant in a given spot, is a lot of how we approach it.
Mm-hmm. Now, you have developed a policy for identifying and dealing with invasive plants in the context of this property that you all manage, the botanic gardens and et cetera, there. And when I read, when you shared with me your policy, And I read it, I thought, well, we all need a policy. You know, each of us, even gardeners, you know, need a policy, because again, turning our backs or not paying attention is going to really catch up with us even faster than it used to. You know, something for me like garlic mustard, you know, that used to be a nuisance is now, I mean, it literally would take up every square foot if you turned your back for a minute. You know,
these, sure.
Yeah. So did you use some of those lists, some of that guidance from the state agencies in developing your policy and figuring out what was over the line in terms of being invasive versus just a weed? Or?
Absolutely. Yeah, it's, again, in the context of climate change, there are New York State regulated lists. You know, these are the plants that you do not propagate or sell. As a botanic garden, we shouldn't be planting those plants as well. But considering climate change, there are plants in Pennsylvania, Maryland, that we have in our collections. There's no guidance from New York State necessarily, but there is in those other states. And so part of our policy as we crafted it was to look at the states around us. If our climate warms, what could be a challenge in the near future?
Right. Because as our frost-free or season gets longer, and I use that as a rough frost-free season, I mean, you know, the plants are sort of awake, and again, that's in quotes too, longer, it seems like. I mean, it seems like these, not just the plants, a lot of the pests as well, seem to have an opportunity to, proliferate over a longer period of time each year and benefit from this additional time, this additional sort of growing season that we've been experiencing.
Absolutely. One of the competitive strategies for many of the non-native invasive plants is that they're leafing out earlier than native flora. They're holding on to their foliage later into the year. We had our lowest temperature for the nearby weather station last year was 3 degrees. So several degrees warmer than we would expect for upstate New York. It was amazing this spring, seeing the honeysuckle and the buckthorns, how early they leafed out. So yeah, that longer season that's just more fruit for them at the end of the year, more energy for them to keep spreading around.
Right. I think in the policy you have one of the statements was, and I'll quote, as the global climate changes, plants that have not previously been of concern are changing behaviors. And you just were referring to that a minute ago and what you're saying about like looking at states nearby, because what's the next character that's going to behave in an insidious way where we are as well? I mean, making those sort of predictions and trying to stay ahead of it. I mean, it's tough, but you're saying looking at some of these state lists and the lists from the adjacent states, and those are pretty easy to find on Google. If we say, invasive species, New York State, invasive species, you know, Maryland, invasive species, you know, where Arizona, whatever it is, each state has this type of list. So that's one bit of homework we can do to get sort of acquainted with the thinking. Yeah. Okay. What are the areas, I mean, with you guys, you know, you're protecting your collections is one thing, you know, the garden has the botanic gardens and arboretum and so forth, you're protecting your collections, but in the context of like other environments, not a public garden, I mean, I feel like the property line, I think of it as the ecotone, or, you know, where different habitats come together, like the woodland edge. I think of these areas where most of the trouble seems to be happening. Do you know what I mean? Like,
yeah.
Just like that roadside example I used earlier. It's like, where should we be looking and where should we be focusing a lot of our attention and so forth?
That brings an interesting point. You're talking about our botanic garden. We have an arboretum, a botanic garden and natural areas.
Yes.
Frequently, it is different staff working in those places. So as we're curating collections in the Arboretum, our neighbors are the natural areas staff. And we're excited about this brand new plant that has come in. And they are terrified that it's potentially going to get bird vectored right over into their natural area across the street. So I think for somebody at home, it's important to be a good neighbor, firstly. Think about what you're bringing into your garden, staying present, paying attention to what's already there. Part of our policy has a monitoring capacity. And over the last few years, we've seen things like Coleuteria, golden rain tree, that has exploded in invasive capacity. The Japanese Katsura, even. That Katsura is starting to seed in. We're finding tall, happy individuals in our natural areas, either coming from campus or from botanic collections. So yeah, keeping an eye on what you have. And as you suggested, the best places to look are frequently those hedgerows. Many of these invasive trees especially, they're going to be windspread or bird vectored. And those birds, they'll come to the tree, they'll eat the fruit, and they head right back to the hedgerow. And as we've seen in the Arboretum, there it's frequently the hedgerow is heading towards the water.
Oh.
So that's where we monitor for things leaving the collection.
They've had a little snack, and now they're on their way to have a drink.
Yeah. Huh. Right? And then grab that waterway and spread those trees right downriver. So yeah, it can be concerning.
Yeah, I mean, you know, barberry, Japanese barberry, which is, I think, on many states' invasive lists. Multiflora rose, of course, Oriental bittersweet. I mean, these are some of the things when you just described that, I'm thinking that's what I see, you know, kind of at the base of certain trees that birds like to, frugivorous, you know, fruit eating birds like to sit in and and then poop out the remains of their meal and so forth. That's where I'm finding a lot of these seedlings, you know, at the mm-hmm. at the base of, you know, beneath a particularly well-placed branch that they might like to be perched in. And, you know, that's where I'm weeding this stuff out over and over and over and over and over again. But yeah, I think, and when I look along the roadsides, I mean, you see just trees just strangled by things like the Oriental bittersweet, for example.
It's heartbreaking. Yeah.
Yeah, it's I mean, that's one that I think is in the Northeast. I don't know about elsewhere, but in the Northeast has made a huge impact in the last couple decades. You know, destructive impact. So we're thinking about that, but then, and you know, there's can be wind spread, there can be bird spread. There's also herbaceous things, that just spread like mugwort or, you know, some that spread underground, like mugwort, the Artemisia vulgaris mm-hmm. or whatever. And then I mentioned earlier, you know, like garlic mustard, for instance, you know, that has lots of strategies, but it's a prolific seeder. Mm-hmm. You know, one of its strategies for succeeding as a weed or invasive is it's a prolific seeder. What about those? I mean, are you also, I mean, I know you're an arboriculture person, but are you also dealing with the herbaceous weed layer, the invasive layer?
Constantly. Yeah. You know, like we want a healthy native intact forest, and currently in that forest is choked with buckthorn and honeysuckle, and where it isn't, there's maybe a carpet of periwinkle or other kind of ground spreading things that maybe they're allelopathic, you know, secreting these chemicals that make establishment of other plants challenging. So, yes, absolutely. We do have to manage those spaces. You mentioned garlic mustard. And again, this isn't my area of expertise, but what I understand, there's a researcher at Cornell, Bernd Blasi, Dr. Bernd Blasi. And some of what he suggested is that plant, this is a very simple summary, but it is so allelopathic that as garlic mustard completely overtakes an area, It can actually choke itself out, and you'll see succession of other things in those places. It's been a minute since I read that paper. But yeah, that's one plant that the more we learned, we're doing less control for garlic mustard, and we're instead shifting towards pale swallowwort, for instance.
Mm-hmm. So there's hope. You're telling me there's hope?
Well, yeah, they're so aggressive. They're taking care of themselves. So yeah, a couple victories here and there.
They shoot themselves in the foot, huh?
Right. Okay.
Yeah, here stilt grass has made its first in my area and in sort of the Berkshire Mountain sort of area, some of the foothilly areas where New York and Massachusetts join. Stilt grass is getting an edge the last few years. You know, I mean, there's just so many possibilities. It's pretty overwhelming. But with the woody things, back to the woody things. So I mentioned seedlings, you know, so there's a lot of privet and along the roadsides around here, you know, that comes from old houses that used to be here however long ago and had privet hedges and so forth. And so there's privet, a supply of privet that makes more seeds every year and the birds move those around. Again, the barberry, the honeysuckles, the bittersweet, the multiflora rose, you know, so I go after all those, but let's say you have a larger than a seedling, you know, something larger than a seedling. What's your favorite way to, I mean, it's a lot of digging to get them out. Do you have any tricks for for woody plant removal, woody invasive removal, a favorite tool or anything like that?
Yeah. There's a couple things that I really like. I can't speak for the rest of the team, but for anything that I cannot stand over and tear out of the ground with my own two hands, I will first turn towards a weed wrench. There's another one we have called a polar bear, P-U-L-L-E-R. It's a clamp-like device that you can clamp around the base of the woody plant. And there's a fulcrum on the back of it. And using that mechanical advantage, you can really easily tear some of these plants right out of the ground. You're saving on using herbicide. You're not turning over a big mass of this soil and releasing that seed bank if you would have been using a mattock or something to excavate. I just think they're great tools.
So the polar bear, which is a kind of a weed wrench type of,
you know, I wonder if they still make it. I was on the weed wrench website and awesome.
The polar bear has a website. I know that. I'll give some links in the transcript of the show over on awaytogarden.com. But that's interesting because a number of my friends in recent years have invested in these sort of weed wrench types of things because it makes it possible for, it saves a lot of time. And as you say, it does less soil disturbance than digging.
Is it one of those tools that as your friends got it, they feel like they have to talk about it with everybody around them?
Yes, that's I've been subjected to a lot of weed wrench talk. Interesting, but I'm glad to hear that you also find it helpful. I think I'm going to have to invest just for me, for managing along the roadside, you know, sort of the property edge and things like that. I feel like it would be really helpful. And you just said seed bank, and that's another big issue, not just if we, you know, dig around and we upturn, you know, we expose more weed seeds that are in the seed bank in the ground to light, and then they can germinate, favorable conditions for germination, and we end up with more weeds of different kinds. But the fact that this is never really a one and done kind of a situation when we're working with either weeds or invasives, the times I've made the worst mistakes, I've put in the effort to try to get rid of something, but then I've not left the area sort of, I haven't waited and gone back a second year and maybe even a third year and cleared it again and again and again. Do you know what I mean? Like I've been in a hurry to, okay, now I can put something in there. Now I can replant, right?
Yeah, I mean, replanting is important, but just like birds and winds are, wind is spreading these seeds, there's plenty of seed that falls right below the plant. So when we tear it out of the ground, Or just remove it. That's a lot of sun getting to the ground now. That can help initiate that seed bank. So all of those same invasive plants are pushing up seedlings the next year. So yeah, as you suggested, absolutely a revisit and getting anything that was missed or new seedlings. I try to have some kind of mowing regimen that I'm doing after I clear a large area of the woodies. I want to be able to maintain it with mowing, maybe like just a once a year mowing, while I'm waiting for my caged trees to get large enough to hold some of that sun on their own.
Oh, so you've put in the replacement trees, but you want to be able to maintain the ground around them in a way to knock back anything that emerges other than those trees. Okay.
The root zone right around the tree, you know, I have my caging around it for deer protection because they're the first thing to wipe out the new trees. I can maintain that tree root zone by hand. But if there's, you know, several hundred square feet of area around it, I would rather be able to mow that once a year and just to ensure that a succession back to an invasive forest isn't going to happen.
Right. And with removal of herbaceous invasives, I mean, this is, again, where I've really blown it. You know, I've gone through the tedium of taking out, you know, things with rhizomatous kind of underground, you know, behavior, and then I have replanted too soon, as opposed to wait another, you know, either tarp it or something, or wait until the next year, let whatever comes up do another removal and another removal after that. You know what I mean? It's not immediate. The clearing, it looks cleaned up, but it's not, right? It's not.
Yeah, taking a little bit of time. I have had several heartbreaks where I've cleared an area of invasives and then the bindweed takes over my tree cages and my new trees or the things that I didn't see on the site when I did the first clearing. So yeah, taking your time. This is a several years process.
Right. So I want to, you know, we have maybe 5-6 minutes left, but I wanted to to just ask you, you know, you mentioned herbicides briefly at close to the beginning of our conversation. And, you know, I know people are, I'm an organic gardener and I don't want to use herbicides, but I know that conservation organizations use them in the name of the greater good to care for, to clean up and then care for, to be able to replant and restore plant communities, you know, that have been overtaken by this. So, are they sometimes called for? And if so, what's the most kind of the way that they should be used? Because we're not talking about broadcast spraying hundreds of gallons over a large area, right? I mean, we're...
This is a really tricky question for institutions and agencies to answer. I can answer this personally for me. There's a couple goals, ideas around ethics. So do the least amount of harm to a site. If you can mechanically remove plants, then do it. If the scale is such that there's some need for herbicide, do it sparingly. One of the ways that we accomplish that is a cut and paint method. So let's take a honeysuckle. It's occupied, you know, it's 8 feet tall, holding a lot of sun and soil space. Removing that at the base with a chainsaw cut, taking the woody material and maybe future seeds off-site, and then painting herbicide around just the cambium at the base of the ground. That it helps us prevent regeneration from that incredibly established root, and we can start developing the site right away. There, another aspect of the ethics around it is to be educated on what you're doing. I've had people call and say, I want X or Y chemical because I just want to kill this plant. And it's important to know the labels and to understand what, how are you potentially compromising your safety or your pets or the people around you if you're not reading that label. So really be aware of what you're doing.
Right. I mean, like, certain types anywhere near water, for instance, are incredibly lethal. You know, they can do additional harm to many, many, many creatures, for example. You know, and people don't, as you point out, read the labels. But you're talking about a cut and paint kind of, you know, using a dauber or whatever to just get a little bit of that chemical onto the base of the removed plant so that it doesn't regenerate. I see.
Yeah. And doing it at the correct time of year too, you know, many of these woody plants, they are going to begin translocating as fall comes. They're moving energy from the tips of their branches down into their roots. And so if we can time a cut and paint with that translocation, we're going to get really good uptake and we're not going to have to do repeat applications. Conversely, if you try to do that in the spring when all the water, juice, energy is going the other direction, it's just, it has a good chance to push the herbicide out of the cut you've just put it on. So yeah, good timing as well.
Okay. All in the name of minimizing the use. So just in the last minute or so, are you on any particular campaigns at the moment against any particular invasives? Is there anything that's really, you know, you're on the warpath against at the moment there? I mean, as I've said three times or so already, bittersweet, bittersweet, bittersweet. That's the one here that just won't relent. So.
Yeah, it's an awesome question because I didn't think that I was until you asked the question, and then there was something that immediately came to mind. So apparently I am. This season, I'm battling Acer Ganalla. It's looking lovely right now. We've got, you know, nice fruit. The foliage is starting to red up. You also hear it as Acer Tartaricum subspecies Ganalla. This is a common street tree. You still see this street tree in many plant catalogs, but it is powerfully invasive when it moves into an open space. So there are a couple field areas where I've been brush mowing to just get access to these trees so that we can begin controlling them this fall.
Okay. Well, I hope that one isn't coming to visit me anytime soon. Thank you very much.
I have some seed enough. If you'd like. We could send it out.
Don't be so generous.
Okay. Cheers.
Oh, Daniel. Well, thank you very much for, and I'll give people, again, links to some of the things we've talked about with the transcript of the show over on awaytogarden.com. But thank you very
Sounds
much
great.
For kind of bringing this up that, you know, that we need a strategy and we need to do a little homework first. And know what we're targeting and when and how. So I appreciate it. It's nice to speak to you, and I'll talk to you again soon, I hope.
Always a pleasure. Until then, good luck with your day.
Thank you.
Cheers. Bye.
Bye. And I hope I'll talk to all the rest of you again soon. Now, don't miss an episode. You can subscribe free to the podcast version of the show on Spotify or on Apple Podcasts. And you can find me anytime at awaytogarden.com and on Facebook and on Instagram as @AwayToGarden. And happy gardening meantime.
Underwriting support for A Way to Garden provided by Color Blends Wholesale Flower Bulbs, a third-generation bulb company offering top-size flower bulbs directly to landscape professionals and ambitious residential gardeners at wholesale prices. On the web, colorblends.com. And by High Mowing Seeds, Wolcott, Vermont, offering 30 new seed varieties for 2024. Professional quality vegetable, flower, and herbal seeds that are 100% organic and non-GMO project verified. On the web, highmowingseeds.com. And by White Flower Farm, offering a wide range of carefully selected and expertly grown garden plants. On the web, whiteflowerfarm.com.
A Way to Garden with Margaret Roach is a joint production of awaytogarden.com and the smallest NPR station in the nation, Robin Hood Radio.